Now stay tuned for the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
Hey, good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for being with us here, Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on The Wren. Our guest today is Professor Richard Schrager, UVA's Law School and the Senior Fellow at the Miller Center. Focuses on the intersection of constitutional law and local government law, federalism, urban policy, and the constitutional and economic status of cities. He also writes about law and religion. He teaches about property and local government law, urban law and policy, churches and state. He's the author of City Power, Urban Governance in a Global Age, with degrees from Harvard Law School, University College London, and the University of Pennsylvania. Good morning, Professor.
Hi, Rick. Nice to be here.
And thank you so much for joining us. You know, you and I planned this program several weeks ago. I had a thought with all that was going on in the world, or certainly in the United States, with some specific elected officials about their roles and what they were being challenged to do or what they were choosing to do. And I wanted to do a show on the role of elected officials, their constitutional roles, what the constituents were asking them to perform as their roles, and their personal choices for roles. And then we have Wednesday, January 6th. So we certainly have a lot to talk about, and we can fill an hour easily. So thanks for being here.
Sure. Great to be here.
One of the things that I'll start you off on is, can you share with us the challenge of what an elected official is doing? And I'm not speaking just to a federal official, but a state official, a local official. But when they have to fulfill a constitutional role, when a constituent has a preference for their choices, whether they were on the winning team or the losing team, and then this individual performing the role may have personal beliefs that agree or disagree with this, it seems to be a battle, an internal battle that they would fight daily.
So Rick, you know, I think we see this obviously a lot. I think the place to start is with the law. Elected officials are of all levels, federal or state or local, are fulfilling certain kinds of constitutional and statutory roles. And so one example for that's a pretty easy one that we talk about a lot in the law school are judges. Judges may have personal views about the outcome of cases. They may have personal views about what the law should look like, but they are oath-bound to apply the law. Now, in many cases, judges have lots of discretion. But in those cases where there isn't a great deal of discretion, and we can talk about how much leeway they do have, they are supposed to apply the law without, at least the classic view is without making decisions about cases that are being consistent with their own personal preferences. That is, they're supposed to apply the law, not make the law.
But, I mean, if we stick with judges, we specifically have different individuals elected to fulfill a role, whether it's a president or a governor or whatever position they hold, who can choose a judge, and they specifically select a certain judge because they believe that that judge is not going to apply the law to what the Constitution is written in a formal manner, but to what the judge may wish for and has the leniency to lean towards, correct?
Well, there's certainly, obviously, ideology is involved, and that's why you have selection of judges, and they're going to lean towards, say, one party or the other, and the ideology of the judge is quite important to presidents who seek to appoint them, the Senate, which seeks to confirm those judges. There are lots of elected judges in the states, in the state system. Often judges are running and are popularly elected. So there is in these arenas, especially with judges, and we can talk about other officers too, but in the judicial arena, there is a unclear mix of law and politics. And certainly politics plays a role in how judges make decisions, how they decide cases. We've seen evidence that judges appointed by Donald Trump are going to be more sympathetic to certain kinds of arguments than judges appointed by Barack Obama. That's a common knowledge. But at the end of the day, and what we hope is that these appointed or elected officials will show some level of fidelity to the law, whatever that might be. Certainly, when they read a statute or a constitution that has clear instructions, they're supposed to follow those clear instructions. Often the law is not clear, though, so there is a great deal of room for discretion in those spaces. But where the law is clear, there is an expectation that these people are playing a role and that they should follow either precedent or statute or constitutional language that is supposed to constrain them, even if their personal preferences or their political preferences are supposed to be or differ from that law or constitutional language.
We are talking about the role of elected officials. Professor Richard Schager here with us from UVA's Law School. So, Professor, let's talk about the constitutional roles for a minute. In many cases, outside of the judicial aspect, and maybe judges fall into this as well, you often think of the fact that the elected official is meant to represent a group. Do these jobs represent in a different way? Does a member of the House of Representatives or the House of Delegates have a different overall representative obligation than, say, the Secretary of State for your state or your Attorney General?
So I think, you know, I think there are there may be some important differences, which is if you take, say, the Secretary of State or the Attorney General of the state, as you mentioned, these are constitutional officers often in state constitutions. They have certain kinds of roles. They have to they're obliged, for example, to engage in certain activities. For example, the Secretary of State is obliged to set up an electoral system and govern that electoral system in the state, and then has certain statutorily defined ministerial, what I would call ministerial duties. And those kinds of duties, like certifying the vote, for example, we could talk about Georgia and the Secretary of State down there. They may have to certify a vote that says that the Democratic candidate won that vote, even if they're Republicans and they would have wished that someone else had won that vote. And that's not a discretionary decision by that officer. Same is true of the Attorney General. The Attorney General of a state has lots of room to make decisions about what kind of lawsuits to bring and who to defend and so on, but generally also has statutory or constitutional obligations that come with the office to, for example, defend all the agencies of that state, right? Or to defend the laws, the existing laws, that the General Assembly or the legislature has passed and adopted. They don't get a lot of discretion in picking and choosing among those laws, although they have some wider discretion in certain other aspects of their exercise of power. Those kinds of roles are might be slightly different than, say, just an elected legislator or a congressperson. They're not playing a ministerial role necessarily. So they go into a body, and because they are engaged in advocating and making law, they're going to engage in a slightly different practice than the folks on the executive branch side, which are charged with implementing the law, again, at least in kind of the classic version of that. So those roles are going to be slightly different. That being said, what we expect from our representatives in the legislature is that they're not supposed to, at least, again, this is in a kind of traditional civic sense, they're not supposed to just represent the party that they happen to come from. They're supposed to represent the constituents of their district, even if they didn't receive votes from some of those. You know, we live in an obviously polarized and partisan era, and there has been lots of talk from some quarters about who the government represents. And what you see there is some claims that, well, I only represent the people that voted for me. And then others saying, well, no, I represent the whole people. Once I'm in office, this is what I'm supposed to do. And that's, again, a matter of political rhetoric and a matter of political ethics, not necessarily a matter of law. We have to think about what kind of representative system we want, in which we do elect folks usually associated with certain kind of political parties. But then they go and represent all the constituents in a particular jurisdiction.
Professor, has the battle between the constitutional definition of the role versus the constituency who voted for you or the demand, because it's not 100% and maybe it's 70-30, but maybe it's 51-49. Has that become a greater issue in recent years, or does it go back for a much greater time than we're choosing to think about in today's news?
So, Rick, I'm not a constitutional historian, but I think we could say that partisanship and party fealty has always been or has long been part of our kind of constitutional DNA. The framers of the Constitution really were concerned about that. They were very much concerned about the problem of factions, and factions for the authors of the Federalist Papers, faction was akin to party commitment, so that the idea was you don't want representatives who come in and they are committed to a faction, that is, to a party. You want them to come in and be committed to the wider polity. That being said, I think what we've seen in more recent times is a form of polarization in which certain elected officials feel like they do not need to be responsive to the whole electorate because they are in districts or have enough votes from just their party loyalists that they can ignore anyone else, and that is, I think, quite damaging. And we've seen it. We see it when President Trump would say, "Well, I'm going to give aid and support to supposedly red states, but not give any aid and support to blue states." And the reason he seems to be able to do that is because he's not relying on the votes of those blue staters, and that means he can ignore a whole group of voters. You see this also in gerrymandered electoral districts or congressional districts. If you are in a safe seat, either Democratic or Republican, you may be able to do whatever you want in that safe seat and ignore the constituents in that district who do not identify with your party, because you're always going to be reelected by the majority of your own party in that gerrymandered district. So this has become a real problem in our electoral politics, because we have severe polarization. We have gerrymandered districts. We have an electoral college in which some states are always going to be blue and some states are always going to be red. That shifts over time, and we've seen some of those shifts in recent times, but that makes it much easier for elected officials simply to ignore a whole swath of the electorate. And I think that is a more recent event that we've seen in the last 20 years or so, and maybe just in the last 10. And it's a significant worry.
Again, we are talking with our guest today, Professor Richard Schrager, about the role of elected officials. Professor, do you think that it's a difference in the personal challenge versus the role? Is one easier than the other if you're in a local position versus a state or a federal position?
So it's a fair question. I think, there is, it seems to me, one dynamic we're seeing, and this is an interesting one in terms of the federal, state, local, political relationship, is that it was more common that local issues would be treated differently than state and national issues, and state issues would be different from national issues. And you might see voters are crossing party lines depending on what level of government you're talking about and what kind of issues were salient to them at that level of government. What we're seeing a lot of is the nationalization of the local issues, the nationalization of state issues, so that folks are much more partisan at the local and state level and are much more likely to vote party lines as opposed to voting the interests of a local or state issue.
I want to come back and talk a little bit more about that, but let's take our first break. We're talking about the role of elected officials, the challenge between the constitutional definition, the request of the constituents, and their personal beliefs. Professor Richard Schrager here, UVA's Law School. He's also a senior fellow at the Miller Center. Hang tight. Be right back. And thank you for being here with us today. 97.9 The Wren, Sunday morning wake-up call, talking with Professor Richard Schrager. The role of elected officials. Professor, before the break, I had asked the question about whether or not the personal challenges versus the constitutional definition of the role of the elected position was easier to separate in a local position versus the state or federal, the challenge that was there versus what I'm being told to do versus what I really wish I could do. I feel like there's a little bit more to the conversation. Keep going. Share that with me.
Sure. Well, you know, one thing that is apparent when you look at local government officials, especially, is they're constrained in ways that state officials sometimes are not, and federal officials are sometimes not. And we're talking about elected officials, in large part because state law sets the boundaries for what locals can do. What the city council can do is often dictated by state law. And then we also have a structure at the local level in which local officials are often engaged in what I'd call ministerial kind of tasks. That is, tasks that they don't have a lot of discretion in performing. And so while elected officials at the local level have a certain amount of power to follow their political and personal preferences, they're also constrained in a lot of ways by state restrictions, state law, and other limits on their authority. So I think all elected officials have to make decisions about what's best for their constituents. We hope that as a matter of political ethics, that's what they're doing. But obviously people get into politics for lots of different reasons, and they might be getting into politics in order to pursue the kind of agenda that they personally approve of. And that's fine. We want them to do that. The voters get to make that choice. What certain elected officials, again, and again, this is usually on the side of the executive branch, are, even though they might be elected, like an attorney general or a city attorney or something like that, or another local official, they might be constrained by state law or even federal law. So it often depends on the level of government, to be sure, but also on the role that this elected official has taken on.
Well, Professor, we've mentioned a couple times the ministerial tasks and the name of the position of Georgia's Secretary of State came up earlier. So let's talk about that individual and his role as an elected official. So Brad Raffensperger, as the Georgia Secretary of State, has been in the news for him probably an unfortunate amount over the past 2 months. Can you talk about the role, constitutional role, of a state secretary of state and the expectation for when he's elected? What is he supposed to do? People don't think about that. They just see names on the ballot, I would think, the majority of individuals, and vote.
Yeah, I think that's right. And we see that, you know, we see that in local elections and in state elections. And part of this is because in the federal system, we don't vote for a lot of constitutional officers, right? So Secretary of State at the state level does something different than the Secretary of State at the federal level. But at the federal level, the Secretary of State's a member of the cabinet, right? Appointed by the president and then confirmed. Or nominated and then confirmed by the Senate. And the Attorney General, for example, answers to the president. So there aren't there aren't constitutional officers in the federal system. There's the president and then a set of cabinet officers that are generally responsive to the president, although there are some questions about that. And we could talk in more detail about that. You also don't elect judges at the federal level. So that is another area in which we don't see this. But at the state level and at the local level, we do elect a number of these constitutional officers. And that is slightly unusual. That might feel slightly unusual. So, for example, in Virginia, we elect a governor and an attorney general. The attorney general could be of a different party than the governor. And that is, of course, unusual. It's not the same thing as in the federal system. We call that a divided executive. But these folks are they're both elected, so they're supposed to be responsive to their constituencies and they might have run on a particular platform of a certain crime, but they also have significant ministerial roles, and that's what you mentioned. And the Secretary of State generally has a certain portfolio of bureaucratic tasks that it is responsible for. In the case of Georgia, the Secretary of State and many other states is the head of the electoral system, or at least is supposed to run that system, and likely has some constitutional requirements derived from the state constitution. For Raffensperger, the task was simply to certify the vote in both the Senate runoff cases and in the presidential election. And the fact that he was a Republican didn't relieve him of the legal obligation to certify the vote if it was appropriately brought to him. And so that's what he did. His position, and it's certainly the correct one, was that he was legally obliged to do so. And despite pressure from President Trump and other Republicans who said you should resign or you should throw the vote to me, he was simply obeying state law. And that is not discretionary. If he took an oath to uphold the state constitution, which I presume he did, that's what he has to do. He doesn't have a lot of leeway. Moreover, it's likely that had he tried to disregard the certification process, he would have been sued and taken to court, and the court would have ordered him to act. So the Secretary of State in that instance doesn't have a lot of room to maneuver, and the demand that he act any differently is a demand that he act illegally and likely unconstitutionally under the Georgia Constitution.
Have we seen any similar situations that come to mind with same party members demanding what you're saying would be illegal behavior, or at least breaking the Constitution, and would come to people being taken to court and probably losing? Have we seen that sort of situation before?
You know, nothing comes to mind immediately. I mean, these are unusual times, Rick. So I think it's pretty surprising when political actors put pressure on, say, the Secretary of State or someone else to disregard the clear commands of a state constitution or state law. And so we don't see it very often. And that's actually to the credit of these offices, which is the folks that engage in this work or that are elected to these positions. They take them very seriously generally, and they don't depart generally from the requirements of their office when those requirements are quite clear. I'm sure there have been efforts to put pressure on these ministerial officials. There's certainly pressure put on them by politicians in various settings, but I haven't seen this kind of pressure. The demand that a Secretary of State disregard the clear mandates of the law, either by resigning or by just ignoring the certification process. That's really striking. And, you know, just to bring it to another example, Vice President Pence, right, on Wednesday into Thursday morning, is tasked under the Constitution of the United States of unsealing the votes of the Electoral College, counting them up, and declaring a winner as the President of the Senate in his ceremonial role, which is a ministerial role. And what we saw is, and he's of the opposite party of Joe Biden. He's a Republican, obviously. And his role was simply to unseal the votes and declare the winner of the Electoral College. And the pressure put on him from the Republican Party, but mainly from President Trump, to disregard his constitutional duty, which is not discretionary, was enormous. He did not choose to take that route. He did carry through his constitutional duty as he had to under the Constitution.
Again, our guest today, Professor Richard Schrager from UVA's Law School and the Miller Center, as we talk about the role of elected officials and the occasional challenge to fill out the constitutional part of the role versus the request of the constituents versus their own personal beliefs. So, Professor, would the Georgia Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, would he have taken an oath of office before fulfilling that role?
Yeah, I would assume so. Generally, constitutional officers at the state level take an oath similar to the oaths that other elected officials, representatives and senators would take. Sure.
Because I found something on a federal, and I unfortunately didn't write down the link, but this was related to federal representatives about their oaths being to be servants of the people. And it said that the oath has three important aspects. First, they swear to support and defend the Constitution. Second, they swear allegiance to the Constitution. And lastly, they promise to do their job well. And I would think that although there may be a greater aspect to each individual position or state's oath, that those three parts are probably included in each oath. Am I wrong to assume that?
So, I don't know what the oath requirements are at the state, at all the state levels, but they often look, they may look quite similar to what you're describing, which is usually involves an oath to uphold and defend, and then to exercise the office in a constitutional manner, and presumably to do it to the best of their ability. Right? This is to do the job well. So I think these aspects, if the oath is taken seriously, and certainly many elected officials do take it seriously, they are bound by law, right, when they're doing their job. Now, that law, we call constitutional law higher law often. It's not statutory law. Usually we treat constitutions as a special kind of law, and it is the case that the Constitution sets forth, and there's a federal constitution or a state constitution, sets forth certain regularities that bind elected officials just as much as they would bind others. And there are specific tasks that that elected officials must undertake. Again, under the federal constitution, that requires the vice president acting as the president of the Senate to declare the Electoral College vote winner. That has been a ceremonial practice up until Wednesday and Thursday, where it became something much, much more seemingly consequential and much more much scarier, actually.
Oh, my goodness. Again, our guest today is Professor Richard Schrager. You know, the next set of questions are a much greater time frame. I want to talk about Attorney General of Texas Ken Paxton and his constitutional role and where we, how he's playing out with his. So let's take our next break, and we'll come back to do that with our guest today. So hang with us, folks. Come back, enjoy the rest of the show. And thanks for being with us today, all the way through Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, role of elected officials and the challenges that they face. Professor Richard Schrager here, Miller Center, UVA Law School. So let's talk about Ken Paxton. He's the Attorney General of Texas, and he's been in the news in the last several months. So, Professor, can you tell us what a state attorney general's constitutional role might be?
So, you know, again, the interesting thing, and I mentioned this before, Rick, is the interesting thing is that the state attorney general are often elected. They're not always elected. That's different from the federal system, so it's important for us to note that. Under the federal system, the president is appoints or nominates an attorney general, is confirmed by the Senate. And then the attorney general is the head of is basically the kind of chief law enforcement officer for the federal government. That's the same role at the state level. The attorney general is the kind of the chief law enforcement officer, heads a bureaucracy of basically lawyers and prosecutors. There are also obviously local prosecutors and district attorneys. Those folks are often elected as well. But he's the head of the state law enforcement system, and that includes, of course, defending the state when it's sued in various ways, defending state agencies in various ways, and bringing lawsuits on behalf of the state or the Commonwealth in various courts. And so they have, again, state attorney general have a kind of constitutional role that makes them independent, and this is important, independent of the governor in that state, which again is different from in the federal system for the most part. And so that's an interesting role for state attorneys general. They have a kind of a wider frame in which to operate. But again, they don't make law. They don't sign bills into law, right? They don't have any role in the legislative process. What they have a role is in enforcing the law and bringing lawsuits of various kinds. And so that's what you're seeing. You're seeing a pretty active presence of state attorneys general in using litigation and in using their investigatory powers in ways that are, of course, not legislative, but are being used in ways to influence legislation or influence policy. So we've seen state attorneys general become pretty aggressive all over the country in pursuing what some might think are political aims, and not just being chief law enforcement officers and doing the daily work of defending the state or the Commonwealth.
Well, you know, you talk about this is the way you phrase that last part. When you go to the government webpage for Ken Paxton, his government webpage, .gov, it says in bold letters, large font, Liberty and Justice for Texas. We regularly identify unique threats to Texas and take action to defeat them.
So it's
it right. sounded it sounded both aggressive and somewhat beyond the state of Texas. I don't know if other people hear that the same way I do, but that's my interpretation.
Well, Mr. Paxton has been very assertive, and often the Attorney General's the Attorney General position at the state level is a stepping stone to higher office. Often precedes running for governor. It might precede running for a senator in a state. And Paxton has been very aggressive in defining the interests of the state of Texas quite broadly, but quite consistently with his own political preferences and his own political party's interests. So, for example, one of the lawsuits seeking to overturn the Georgia results, the Georgia presidential results, is brought by Texas and other states, saying that somehow the Georgia system of counting votes affected or somehow injured the interests of Texas citizens. This is a bizarre claim. It was rejected by federal courts, but this was led in part by Mr. Paxton, who's again using litigation, using lawsuits against other states or against the federal government in many cases, to pursue certain kinds of aims. And we've seen that again during the Obama administration. We saw states, including Texas, bringing lawsuits against the federal government repeatedly, either in to contest the healthcare laws, or to contest various other things like environmental laws. And we're going to see that again. And what we will see is that Mr. Paxton will likely be suing the federal government an awful lot on behalf of, at least from his perspective, on behalf of the state of Texas, which he is obligated to defend, but also empowered to sue in favor of. That may not be what the legislature of Texas wants. It might not be what the governor wants, because the attorney general has independent authority to do this. And because they're an elected and constitutional official, their power in that realm is not restrained unless the state restrains it through legislation.
And for listeners who are wondering why I got Ken Paxton in the questions, it's because of that lawsuit to the Supreme Court that were asking to block the electors for the presidential election about these other states, where that made me question, what does this have to do with Texas, and what is the role of the Texas Attorney General that put him on my list of questions? So, Professor Schrager, I ask, what is the role of an elected state official versus the U.S. Constitution? I mean, who wins in this case?
Yeah, so Rick, you're thinking like a lawyer, which is great. So you got it. And what we were, what you're asking is, well, there's a basic principle, which is you can't bring a lawsuit just against anybody. You have to have a real injury. You have to have some kind of something that has hurt you in a certain kind of way. And so the theory of the Texas case, which again is was rejected by the federal courts, is that, well, they're, the voting in Georgia somehow has injured the voting preferences of the Texas of Texas citizens. That doesn't make a ton of sense, right? So that's why that lawsuit was never going to succeed. It was a political, I think it was a political ploy and a kind of last ditch effort, like many of the lawsuits that were filed before and after the presidential election. But it does raise questions about who does this Secretary of State, who does the Attorney General in Texas answer to? And at the end of the day, the Attorney General is the state of Texas answers to the electorate. And if these lawsuits are things that the Texas citizens think are show a certain amount of aggressive style, or if they look like they're advancing the interests of the Texas electorate, they may return him to office. It feels, and I think you're right to feel this way, a little bit outside of this of the Attorney General's lane. They should be concerned with, say, Texas issues. And the courts are going to police that in a certain way. They're going to say, you can't sue about this. This doesn't have anything to do with your citizens. But you have to remember the Texas Attorney General, as other attorney generals, have a wide lot of room to represent citizens in the state. So in California, for example, when same-sex marriage was being litigated, the same-sex marriage cases were being litigated, lots of states came in to represent their citizens who were being affected by bans on same-sex marriage or the failure for other states to recognize those marriages. And those attorneys general were empowered to bring those kinds of lawsuits on behalf of their citizens. So if there was some issue that had affected the Texas citizens directly, then those lawsuits are commonly brought and increasingly brought by attorneys general who are again pursuing through litigation often what they can't pursue through legislation.
Okay, our guest again today, Professor Richard Schrager, UVA's Law School and the Miller Center. So, Professor, we're under 10 minutes. Now, I would think that everyone knows that Wednesday, January 6th, a lot of events happened. And we just can't talk about all of them in a current news manner because we pre-record the show a little bit, and anything we get into too heavily today may be completely out of sync with when the show airs on Sunday. But I would like to talk about the role of an elected sheriff or an elected defender of law in some police manner, because the commentary that's been made on Thursday and since Wednesday was that the individuals who went into the Capitol were not shot or assaulted in the same manner by the security as the folks who were protesting over the summer of 2020. And so give me your feedback on that.
So, Rick, there's a lot to say, obviously, about those events, and they continue to unfold in various ways. But one of the things you point out is just, I think, obvious to the country at this point, is that there have been really differential treatment of the kinds of protesters the responses to those, especially in Washington, D.C., especially when there's federal officers involved. It seems pretty stark that when there's Black Lives Matter protesters, they've been treated quite harshly and with severe force. And what we saw on the television of the invasion of the Capitol is that those protesters seem to be treated much less harshly. There are much less arrests, much less force being used, and that I think is just an obvious observation. It seems just like that's what we're seeing, and so that's a real concern and a real problem that's been raised by lots of people. You know, what I'd say is you raised the elected sheriffs. What we have to remember is different police forces have different structures. And in the city of Washington, there's a police chief. That police chief is not an elected official. Or you have the Capitol Police. Those are not elected officials. But in many places, in Virginia is one of those, but often lots of other states, in the western states, you have elected sheriffs. And those sheriffs are constitutional officers in many cases, that is under state constitutions. And we've seen sheriffs acting with a certain amount of impunity in light of their kind of electoral protection, which is to say that they don't feel particularly beholden by state law or the rule of law in certain cases. And so there's been a lot of concern and articles written about whether the sheriff as a constitutional officer is a good idea to have at all, and what kind of constraints are placed on the sheriff. We've seen, for example, this sort of constitutional sheriff's movement in which the sheriffs say, we don't have to abide by state gun laws, or we don't have to abide by immigration mandates. We're going to enforce the law the way we want to enforce the law. And so there's a feeling that sometimes the sheriffs are pursuing political ends that are often in tension with state law and often in tension with constitutional law. And so the sheriff it seems like an obscure office in many states, but we've seen in recent years that they've exercised a lot of power, often in ways that seem to abuse that power. Not all sheriffs, obviously, but we've seen that much more aggressively, and that would result in, to say, differential application of force in certain cases, with sheriffs making choices on the ground to act differently towards certain protesters as against other protesters. And that is concerning. We also see and worry about certain kinds of policing and public safety officers aligning themselves with certain kind of political groups, not being neutral as among citizenry, and that's a different kind of concern. But it raises the issues you're talking about, which is when a police officer goes out into the world, they're supposed to protect and serve everyone equally, no matter what their race, creed, or color is, and no matter what political party they're associated with. But increasingly, we've seen police departments and police officers and large groups of police officers seeming to align politically with one party or another. And that should make us nervous about the neutrality of the entire justice system. If we demand that judges try to be neutral as among parties in a lawsuit or among criminal defendants and mete out punishment equally to those who are Democrats or Republicans or whatever party they are in, we should also ask that of our police officers and anybody in the criminal justice or justice system as a whole, including the prosecutors. And it should worry us if any parties in those in the criminal justice or in the justice system more broadly, if any actors in that system are playing favorites because of the political party that a defendant happens to be associated with.
So a quick question, and I say this in a somewhat joking manner. Do you think that every sheriff should have a Twitter account?
You know, I think it concerns me when Twitter is being used, you know, in certain kinds of ways for certain kinds of political purposes. But you raise an interesting issue, which is, well, what are the ethics of an elected official who's charged with policing, right? With policing, as opposed to an elected official who's pursuing a legislative agenda. So this, again, why do we elect? You have to ask preceding questions. Well, why would we elect police or sheriffs at all? Should we get rid of elections for them? Most big cities have appointed professional police chiefs, and maybe that's actually what we should have instead of an elected sheriff system.
Again, our guest today, Professor Richard Schrager from UVA's Miller Center and the UVA School of Law. Professor, thank you so much for being with us.
Sure. It was a pleasure, Rick. Thanks for having me on.
And I hope you'll come back one day. I'd love to do a show with you on the church and state. Have a great day.
Thanks so much, Rick.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on Real Oldies 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at SeavillePodcast.com. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for The Wake Up Call, only on 97.9 The Wren.